Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. In this podcast, we sit with uncomfortable silence until it becomes funny, and then we write cheesy memoirs about the experience. Today we're talking about David Lynch, who recently passed away. Specifically, we'll be discussing his movies, Eraserhead out in 1977, Lost Highway out in 1997, and Inland Empire out in 2006. We picked these movies to kind of span his filmography, and also because they're sort of representative of his most surrealistic work. We also read his extra cheesy memoir from 2007, Catching the Big Fish, in which he talks about transcendental meditation, the unity of all things, and art. A quick summary of the movies. Eraserhead is a surrealistic examination of fatherhood, complete with a monstrous mutant baby and a woman in a radiator who stomps on sperm-like creatures with a big smile on her face. Lost Highway is a surrealistic story of a man who may be a boy who may actually be the man, who murdered his wife and made up the story of the boy to escape the psychic pain of his crime, and within that fantasy he confronts the bizarre and terrifying characters of the underworld of L.A., including a gangster porno producer, a femme fatale double of his dead wife, and a mysterious, threatening man with a white face. And finally, Inland Empire is a story of an actress seemingly losing herself in the legacy of a cursed movie. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. Hans and I care quite a bit about Lynch. Maybe Hans more than me, but I feel like I do as well. Patrick, I'm not sure. Patrick, do you have a previous relationship with Lynch prior to reading the book and watching these movies?
I mean, I've seen several of his films and always enjoyed them.
But you didn't have like a box, a shrine to him in your head.
No. Like that. Okay. Like for filmmakers, you know, for me, it's like Ingmar Bergman and Werner Herzog are probably my two favorite filmmakers. But Lynch was always, you know, up there. I always really enjoyed Lynch's movies and thought, like, he was doing cool shit. You know, his book made me think less of him as a human being and a filmmaker. But, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's... Okay, so I think that's an interesting thing to start from, because the book is... The book is very invested in getting the reader to feel a certain way about the transcendental meditation movement, about transcendental meditation practice, about a person's relationship to his term for it, the inner sort of unity of all things that maybe comes off as a bit cheesy and flat. I think that, like, overly credulous.
Mean, like, absolutely.
It's funny because, like, you say that, Hans, but I think that, like, there's a magic to his movies that comes from credulousness. Right, that comes from just basically investing sincerely in very, you know, easily, like, it would be easy to read a lot of, like, his stuff is kind of cheesy, and then he sticks with it. He, like, sits right. He pushes right through the schlock that is available at the surface of these melodramatic moments and find something, I think, pretty amazing. So, you know, while he's overly credulous in his book, you know, in a basically a memoir, and I too kind of found that I wanted to kind of knock him for that. At the same time, it's that same quality that I think is part of what makes his movie so great. But we can talk about that. I mean, he says in his book that he's not good with words, but that cinema is a whole language. So maybe we can pivot to that. You know, his book, I found underwhelming.
To say the least.
Well, Patrick wants to double down on that. I'm trying to be polite. No need to be polite. But like, maybe Patrick, is there something to him saying he's not good with words, but you know, he is an expert in the language of cinema. Is there something in his movies that is valuable in spite of, you know, the lack of value in his book?
I think every film I've seen by him is pretty great, you know. So I absolutely agree that there's something to the idea that, you know, whatever you want to call it, like artistic techniques, cinematic techniques, or the language of film, like he clearly does have a knack for visual representation and visual art that is quite compelling. And his knack for visual art is in, you know, direct opposition to his lack of facility with the written word, I would say.
Do you have an example that comes to mind from any of the three movies that we watched? Of just a cinema language moment?
So our friend Henry in Eraserhead is taking care of the baby, and he isn't sure about how the baby's feeling. He puts a thermometer or whatever you call it in the baby's mouth, and it seems okay. He turns away, and then like there's this jarring moment where there's like a psycho-esque quick crescendo of sound, like I don't know if that's psycho-esque, but and then he turns back to the baby right at this moment of sound, this tense sound, and the baby's face is like covered in pus and boils, and he's like, oh, you really are sick. Like that, you know, that was a very cool moment, I thought, of like telling the reader or the viewer through visual language about what was going on. Visual and audio language.
But also like kind of destabilizing the viewer, right? Because like it is like I think that he uses that you know some tricks in that movie and in all of his movies to like make you feel like, I don't know, he changes like the kind of like the baseline for verisimilitude. Mm-hmm. You know, like it, you're not watching, you know, you in a movie of a different sort of texture or a different sort of tone, you would be jarred by the fact that like the baby was suddenly sick. Mm-hmm. But like in his movies, he creates space to be like a lot more wild and free with like, now this is what's happening. Yeah. You know, and you kind of go with it.
And there's definitely a, like, he seems to eschew or askew or however you say it, the, you know, the typical narrative conventions of film in favor of scenes that are just tense, you know, and that's something that I find super interesting and super engaging, how just every scene in each of the films, even though it seems pretty random from the next, or often, scenes often seem like non sequiturs, the scenes themselves carry enough weight in the acting and the tension that each scene portrays typically keeps me watching.
I like that cut in Eraserhead as an example too, because it's kind of a departure from a lot of the most characteristic ways that he uses editing, right? Like, he's someone who is very well known for holding shots a little bit longer than it makes sense to, according to normal film language, right? Like, there's a way that we're accustomed to seeing cuts and rhythms in movies, and he almost always, I don't know about almost always, but many, many, many things that he's done, there are these little moments where you stay with a scene a little bit longer than you expect, you stay with a shot a little bit longer than you expect, or like things are kind of pushed out in a way that becomes a little bit uncomfortable, partly because of the nature of the what's being shown, but partly also because we're used to a little bit more abrupt, not maybe abrupt is not the word, but we're used to kind of a faster paced rhythm of cutting that he's giving us, right? Like, he uses it as kind of ambient, you said?
Snappy. I mean, we're used to snappy.
Like, we're used to snappy. And I think, like, Chris, you in the questions you had before we started talking, you mentioned Tarkovsky. And I think that's one thing that he and Tarkovsky have a little bit in common, right? Is, I mean, with Tarkovsky, it's taken to the kind of logical extreme, right? Of the, the kind of like anti-ambient, anti-rhythm, right? Where you have these long, 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 long takes. Lynch, I think, doesn't push it. He pushes it about a tenth as far. But I think that they both slow down the language of film in ways that are a little bit jarring, but strangely soothing once you get into them. And the Eraserhead cut, I think, is an interesting one, because any kind of departure from the normal ways that he uses kind of time and pacing in film is going to stand out particularly strongly, right? Like, with that, using a kind of like almost a, I think the term for it is a smash cut, right? Like a cut where there's a sort of like almost a punchline in, again, how you're in defying what you would normally expect for a cut, right? Like, the normal language of cinema tells us when we cut back to the baby will look about the same because of how time works in film, but instead, oh gosh, it's all of a sudden it's, you know, covered in pustules and feverish. And so there's sort of like a meta joke there about our expectations for film that actually requires moving really abruptly ahead instead of slowing down. And those kind of moments stand out more because of, well, especially now, you know, I mean, obviously seeing Eraserhead in a vacuum, you don't know yet what his characteristic techniques are, but looking at something like that now, that sort of like snappy edit joke is actually kind of out of character for him, which makes it stand out more. Another one that I think kind of works not in an identical way, but does roughly an equivalent thing is there's a moment in Inland Empire where Laura Dern is running very slowly along a winding path toward the camera, right? Mm. And the film is slowed down to almost a crawl, and she's running in this very slow, dreamlike haze. And then all of a sudden, the speed of the film, well, it's not film, but the speed of your playback goes from this kind of ultra slow to very sped up, and she abruptly rushes toward the camera and kind of like screams in this distorted way. And it's just the most, I mean, it has no narrative purpose, right? Like, it's an entirely impressionistic scene. But it's just absolutely fucking terrifying, particularly if you're watching it, you know, in a dark room by yourself late at night. And again, I think part of the reason that stands out is because we're used to a particular sort of rhythm from Lynch that is like a bit of a slower, kind of more uncomfortable version of cinema, and to see him like play with time in a more elaborate way like that is very creative and very interesting.
Yeah, and that that shot of Dern, her face, I think, comes back right at the very end from that scene, and is transposed over the face of the phantom or whatever it is that Dern is shooting at the end. I believe that's her face.
Yeah. Kind
of drawn back in a rictus. Well, because you brought it up, Patrick, Hans, I did bring up Tarkovsky and Stalker, which we have discussed on this podcast. And it struck me just watching Eraserhead again. I wanted to look it up, and it predates Stalker by a couple years. Both are shot in an industrial wasteland in black and white. Stalker, partially black and white for part of the movie. Both feature jarring intersections of plant life and human habitation. The main character in both has a mutant child. I don't think that there's really too much to mine from comparing the two, even though I put that in my question. But it does strike me that you said it, now that you said it, Hans, like Tarkovsky has that lingering kind of gaze in his films as well. But in his, it's very like, it's almost it's always kind of tragic, and I guess like it's tragic in Lynch too, but there's a humor in Lynch. Maybe that's the distinction to put in Lynch, where like Lynch, it feels like, is always sort of like partially inviting you to laugh at even some of the more uncomfortable moments because of how patient he is with like strangeness, and how like patient he is with mundane domestic moments that become strange because he's so patient with them, where I don't necessarily feel the same way about Tarkovsky. Tarkovsky's characters can be kind of funny and pathetic, but like, I don't know. Does that make sense? Does that resonate with either of you? Like,
yeah,
it feels like Lynch is
hilarious, you know, sometimes, and Tarkovsky's not.
Yeah. Well, what is the, because it does feel like both. It feels like Tarkovsky can linger on characters, and it feels more like you are examining bugs with a magnifying glass. And Lynch, it feels like you are examining something else. I don't know how to put it, but with Lynch, it does feel like a humor is surfacing.
And Lynch characters do more absurd things. Tarkovsky, I've only seen Stalker and Solaris, but it seems like, you know, like in Lynch, characters will do some real wacky things for no reason, and that can just kind of be funny, whereas Tarkovsky is typically subdued. Like, his characters are typically subdued and under the top, whereas Lynch, the characters are often over the top. So I'd say that seems why to me.
Yeah, I think Tarkovsky's characters are... This is going to sound maybe like an oxymoron, but Tarkovsky characters are grotesque in a subtle way, and Lynch characters are grotesque in a much more overt way, right? Like, I've seen a few different Tarkovsky movies, and, you know, Lynch's characters have these extremes of horrifying evil and deep, warm goodness and comic, you know, they behave in these very bizarre comic ways. And they're almost always, not all of his characters, but many of his characters are kind of an archetype taken to a grotesque extent, right? Like Patricia Arquette's sort of twin characters in Lost Highway. Those are a particular archetype of a seductive femme fatale carried forward to a, you know, kind of grotesque, bizarre extent.
Right.
And the Tarkovsky's characters, I think, are grotesque in the sense that they are tortured, or they're filthy, or they're, you know, they are kind of in these extremes of self-abnegating misery and despair. But at the same time, they feel more like recognizably complex humans that are sort of in these moments of grotesquerie, right? To your if your question was, why is it funny in Lynch and not funny in Tarkovsky, right? Like, that's where you started, is humor in Lynch and humorlessness in Tarkovsky. I think ultimately it, the like Lynch, you have these kind of deeply, Lynch is a tonally jarring filmmaker, right? One of the most interesting things about Lynch is this clash of tones that, could be dissonant, sometimes is disturbing, but I think often like the tonal clash is part of where the humor comes from, whereas Tarkovsky is a tonally, probably one of the most tonally uniform great filmmakers, right? And I say that with great admiration for Tarkovsky.
Yeah. But. Well, it's funny you saying this makes me kind of, at least for the moment, gives me a kind of a lens for arranging the three films that we saw in my head. And I actually, like, I'm kind of feeling right now like Lost Highway for me. And I, this is probably like subject to change, 'cause I think that that's one of the things that, like, Tarkovsky, you watch Stalker over and over, and like characters are not literally not saying a damn thing. They're just sitting there and you'll notice different things, which is fucking crazy magic. On the part of Tarkovsky, and similarly with Lynch. So like right now, like watching these three, could have been just like when I was watching them, I kind of felt like Lost Highway was the least funny for me, like the least, like you know,
I'll say Lost Highway. I thought it was hilarious.
That's the thing. Like, it's so hard to nail down, because like Eraserhead, I don't remember Henry's wife's father's, if he even has a name, but like his father-in-law is fucking hilarious. Like, it is like that scene, especially like coming out of like the really surreal beginning of Eraserhead. And then you're just basically plopped into this very jarring domestic scene where Henry is meeting his, he's met them before, but he's having dinner at their house and learning that he's a father, and his father-in-law is so outside of the conversation and so strange, and it's hilarious. And like, you know, I think that like you see that scene and you know that this guy is going to be a great filmmaker, because it is such a, I don't know. It's fucking hilarious. It's really strange. It's everything. I really fell in love with that. And I just didn't feel the same this time about Lost Highway. You're saying that, 'cause I've seen Lost Highway before, and I think I felt, even though this time around, I did feel like I really did get much more of what Lost Highway was about. Maybe it's just kind of the actors. I don't know. Like, I actually felt like Arquette and Pullman and whatever the kid's name is, the actor who plays Balthazar Getty, they all just kind of looked constipated to me. I don't know. Like, I didn't quite get the humor of Lost Highway, and maybe that's why in my heart right now I kind of ranking it lower.
Lost Highway is probably my favorite of the three, but I do think that Pullman and Arquette are not great actors.
For Lynch. Maybe, they're not great Lynch.
Yeah, maybe not for Lynch. Like, I do think Arquette has a pretty cool scene where It's with Balthazar Getty, and she is like, you know, you gotta help me. Mr. Eddie's gonna kill me. You know, you gotta help me. And she's being very pathetic, and then Pete, Balthazar Getty's character, agrees to like do the robbery, and she falls back on the bed, and like it's clear that, you know, she's kind of been planning this, and like her voice gets calm and she gets kind of distant. So I think that was a pretty good character moment, but like a moment of acting. But I do think Pullman and Arquette, I mean, aren't great for the film. That said, Robert Loggia as Dick Laurent / Mr. Yeah. Eddie is hilarious. Like, I thought he was funny, man.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's like, they're tailgating that guy, and he like the guy tailgates him, and he smashes into him and like grabs him and says, Don't you know, you four Carlings or something. Like, I'm just cracking up at that shit. And then later on when Fred / Pullman like abducts him, I thought he was pretty funny in that scene, like, you know, attacking, they're fighting, and then Fred gets the better of him, and he's just kind of looking up and like asking weird questions. I thought that was cool.
And I think that the off the top of my head, and you know, this might be something I could be talked out of, but I think that the style of the humor in Eraserhead and Lost Highway is actually very similar, in the sense that it's kind of like a grotesque version of classic, like, straight man humor, right? You have Henry in Eraserhead, and all these bizarre things are happening around him, and he's in this kind of state of perpetual dismay and confusion. Yeah. And a great deal of the humor, you know, like, I think a lot of what, particularly a lot of the business with the baby, right?
Right.
In a vacuum, without Henry's reactions, would not be funny at all. But the contrast between this bizarre, grotesque baby puppet that they made out of a cow fetus and Jack Nance's reactions, the gulf between those, the kind of this person who almost has a normal perspective being just sort of in a kind of constant state of dismay in this bizarre world, I find that funny, mm-hmm. right? And the yes. same thing, I think, goes for a lot of the humor, at least in the scenes that you were talking about, Patrick, in Lost Highway, right? Where it's funny that the gangster, it's funny that Mr. Eddie is terrifying this random motorist and you know, beating up this random motorist, partly because of... In a vacuum, it might be less funny, but it's funny because we are seeing it from the perspective of this person who right. is... Getty is the straight man, and Getty is understanding the danger of being as wrapped up in this person's life as he is secretly becoming. Right. And there's a kind of like, there's a humor in that, I think. And not all of Lynch's work that's funny is funny in the same way, right? Like Wild yeah. at Heart is very funny, but there isn't really a straight man character in Wild at Heart. Everyone is grotesque, right? And so the humor has to arise in different ways because it's happening without a grounded character around to observe it.
Yeah, I mean, like Inland Empire is...
The rabbits were
so destabilized. Yeah, it's so destabilized. I'm not sure, because actually, you've never seen Wild at Heart. I really want to, but yeah, Inland Empire has a different locus of at its center that is, you know, not like straight man confronted by, you know, bizarre. Because you know, our protagonist herself is not like a continuous person. As we, you know, so like it's so hard to, I mean, the rabbits are hilarious, but also disturbing. You know, there's a guy that one of Laura Dern's characters talks to that is just basically sitting there. He's this pudgy guy with glasses, and he says like one word. And for some fucking reason, every time it cuts back to him to not say anything, like, it just becomes funny for me. Like, just like this guy is just like basically hired to sit there. And then like his lines happen off screen. He just sort of like walks to another room and you can overhear him talking on the phone. And then Terry Crews pops up. Homeless person. Yeah. And it's just fucking funny. And it's like, and the kind of like ensemble, there's something about the ensemble nature of some of his stuff too. Like, the most recent Twin Peaks has this where it's just sort of like, you know, Michael Cera dropping 5 minutes of totally bizarre heat. Like, and you know, I guess maybe, I don't know. I'll go back to what you were saying, Patrick, like maybe the fact that like Lost Highway is more of a, well, what both of you are saying, if Lost Highway is more of a straight man like based sort of structure, I just don't think that the acting quite pulls it off. Jack Nance is incredible in Eraserhead. Like he's great. He's amazing. And I just didn't feel the same way. And I really admire Lost Highway. I think like structurally, maybe it's the one that I admire the most, but I also felt the least titillated by it moment by moment.
Mm. I once had a fish named after Balthazar Getty, but I still don't think he's one of the better actors Lynch has ever worked with.
No, Dern is obviously the best.
Yeah, Laura Dern was,
she really is incredible.
Pretty fantastic in Inland Empire. I think Inland Empire was, I thought Lost Highway and Eraserhead were funny. I thought the rabbits were funny in Inland Empire, but I didn't think it was super funny the way I thought Eraserhead and Lost Highway.
There's a shot where Justin Theroux walks into the room and walks up to the camera, like in this very kind of rapid. It basically, it's unclear to me whether this is meant to be in the character of the in the characters that they're playing in the movie. I think that it is, given the accents that they have. But she's talking to Justin Theroux, but I think she's calling him Billy.
Yeah,
which is.
Is it? Is she? Is Dern all kind of hyped up and like saying "I love you," and he kind of has this weird tilted. His head is tilted weird, and he has a weird look on his face.
That scene is fucking hilarious. Like, this is the second time that I've seen Inland Empire, and there's something about how he's shot walking into the room that sets up just how melodramatic it is and funny. And then also, I mean, again, you know, I think Han said this, but like the kind of magic of that scene is that I can't tell whether to feel like distraught or like I'm about to crack up. I found Inland Empire this time around pretty funny, personally. Hans, is it because you've watched it many times now? Is it funny for you? Inland Empire for you?
I mean, I'm thinking about it now, and the last time that I watched Inland Empire, and I'll say here just as a confession, I did not watch these films in this past week. Because I happen to live somewhere, this is going to sound snotty. I happen to live somewhere with a really good, like repertory art house theater. And so actually all three of these movies I've seen them in the theater in the last maybe year and a half or so.
That's great.
And it was interesting in particular, this is like somewhat off topic to your question, but it was interesting to me how much more the humor of Eraserhead comes through in the theater, because when you see it on a large screen, so much of so much of the humor comes from like subtle details of Nance's performance, for instance, right? And those, because it, you know, it's lit and shot in kind of an odd way, and it's, you know, a lot of the copies that I'd seen over the years were not the highest quality. seeing into the theater, you really get a sense of the nuances of that performance in a way that I had never thought of it as a funny movie, oddly enough. And I walked away from it thinking almost like the kind of primary response of it is humor. And I think with Inland Empire, there are certainly things that you can read as in some way humorous, right? But I found that the last time that I watched Inland Empire, which was in the theater here, I found that it's melancholy, actually, in a way that not a lot of his other movies are, right? There's a kind of an underlying sadness to a lot of the performances and the imagery that felt really kind of, it just felt poignant in a way that I was not expecting, right? And I think that does have to do with, to get that response from it, I mean, I think it helps to have watched it a couple times so that you are not quite so much thinking about just how lost you are in the narrative or the anti-narrative, right? And I think it helps as well to try to kind of sit with it in the most focused way that you can. But there's a kind of just, I don't know, like so many of the scenes, when Dern's ego is fracturing, there are these scenes that are just kind of like her in these depressing apartments or drab backyards or sort of like just gross, poor looking places. And there's a sort of a lost melancholy in that that's very profound. The scene, one of the kind of most, I don't really know exactly narratively what's happening, but one of the scenes that's the most memorable is when she's, you know, she's been stabbed with a screwdriver and she's dying on the sidewalk in LA, and Terry Crews and his girlfriend and the woman next to the woman, the it's okay lady, you just dying, that woman. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's just such a deep sadness.
That's a great
in
scene.
In that scene.
Yeah, it's
that is
excellent.
A great, great scene. And I think that the melancholy, even though so many of Lynch's movies contain something sad or something elegiac or funereal, I think that there's not that much violence really in Inland Empire. There's not nearly as much humor. And so I think that the kind of elegiac quality of it, once it becomes familiar enough to start connecting with on an emotional level, the sadness is really far and away what you come away from that movie with. You know, even the kind of final scene, the credit scene of all the women dancing to Sinner Man by Nina Simone, like, that's heaven, right? Like, that's, you know, still, there's still an elegiac quality to that, because in some way that is, as joyful and exuberant as that is, like, that is also kind of a funeral hymn for Laura Dern's character, as I've always understood it.
Yeah, I wonder if my own reaction is kind of discomfort, because it does feel like Inland Empire was cohering into, it felt like all three of these movies cohered into, not necessarily simplistic, but simple ideas or feelings. It's very hard to kind of like disentangle those, because like it feels like the themes in these movies are actually like there to be, you know, disentangled from, you know, the complexities in how the stories are told. Like Lynch is trying to say something, and it felt like that something was much clearer for me this time around through these movies. I think this is maybe my third time seeing Eraserhead, maybe my second time seeing Lost Highway, and my second time seeing Inland Empire. So I think that, like, I wonder if Inland Empire is funny for me at this point, because it's just one more layer to get through to kind of like get to what you're talking about. But I'm curious what you guys think about that. Does that resonate for you Patrick, because you are looking for, you know, the stories that you take in to say something. And it felt to me like these were saying, each of them was saying something.
Yeah, I feel like I could have a pretty coherent statement of what Eraserhead and Lost Highway are saying. And I think I could come up with a close guess for Inland Empire, right? I thought I had seen Inland Empire before, but I hadn't. I was thinking of Mulholland Drive, which I have seen. So Inland Empire, this was the first time I saw it. But yeah.
I was just going to say, we talked in the last episode when we were doing Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut, we talked about, you kind of talked me into a realization, Patrick, which was that the aesthetic simplicity of the text was leading me to underrate its thematic complexity, right?
Mm, sure.
And I think that, you know, Lynch's movies, I think for people who are coming to them for the first time or the first couple times, they have a mirror of that, where because the text is kind of structurally complex, aesthetically complex, we think that it's going to be thematically complex, or we have an urge to try to find complicated or ambiguous meanings. But in fact, I do think that much of the time the idea is actually relatively simple, right?
Right,
like you said, agreed. You know, in Eraserhead, like you said, Patrick, it's the kind of the fear and confinement of parenthood. In Lost Highway, it's jealousy, right? And the kind of the things that jealousy drives us to. Inland Empire, and with Inland Empire, I think that it is a bit less clear, as you would imagine from something that kind of dense. But I guess I read Inland Empire, there's a podcast that I listened to a while ago where they were talking about The Fly by David Cronenberg, right? And the idea that The Fly is partly about the ways that desire makes us monstrous, right? That when you desire, particularly romantic and sexual desire, right? That like truly falling in love, having a truly transformative, deep erotic experience, part of what that involves is the feeling of discovering something within yourself that is strange and unexpected and can even be read as monstrous. And I think that, you know, Chris, one of your questions was about how women are represented in David Lynch's films and the kind of hatred and fear that they inspire, at least in these selections. Right. And to me, it always seemed like that was less a question of women in particular and more about the ways in which desire is terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. It is terrifying to want. It's fucking just scary. And so often, you know, people that we truly desire scare us, and the act of desiring, the kind of vulnerability of that. You know, I think Eraserhead is very, very much about the kind of the parenthood, the questions of parenthood that we talk about. But I think it's partly also a little bit about how the people that we desire are frightening and monstrous to us. And I think, you know, Lost Highway, Patricia Arquette is this kind of object of desire, and there's a sort of monstrous self that kind of awakens in Pullman and Getty, who, you know, are kind of to one extent or another the same person. And I think Inland Empire is to some extent a mirror of that, right? Where like Laura Dern's character falling in love with Justin Theroux's character, or wanting Justin Theroux's character, like that causes sort of a kind of ego disintegration, right? And a essentially like a fugue state, a psychotic break. And that, so I think actually those are thematically fairly connected, because they are both about just the totally kind of terrifying the ways that desire sort of terrifyingly deconstructs ourselves and makes us existentially vulnerable. And I think that, like, once you figure out, I don't think that these are the only thematic or emotional pathways into these films, but I think that if you're someone who goes into a complicated text wanting to fit everything into a schema, you're going to be frustrated by these films. But if you go in with a kind of your whatever sort of emotional idea makes the most sense for you and inhabit it within that emotional idea, then it becomes much easier to make it feel as though everything in some way connects, even if you can't slot everything into kind of a diagram.
That's a good kind of way of explaining it, because that's actually what I do whenever I watch a Lynch film. I think I know I'm not going to get narrative cohesion really of any kind. Like, there are going to be causal impossibilities in his films, which are just kind of satisfying as an experience. So, you know, I like to say, well, this is kind of the emotional space, like fear and confinement of fatherhood that I'm meant to inhabit right now. So I think that's a, you know, kind of a great explanation, Hans.
And that's actually one reason that Mulholland Drive, even though that was initially my favorite Lynch movie and one of my favorite movies, like, it's one reason that it honestly hasn't aged as well for me as some of his other work, because it does actually, for the most part, because it has this kind of A-B quality where the first half is a dream of the character in the second half, it actually is very schematic in, okay, this bit goes to this bit goes to this, right? Like, and it took a few watches to get to that point, but essentially, like, the first half is Naomi Watts' dream, the second half is her life, and everything in the first half is a subconscious reimagining of some detail or character or event from the second half. And it is very poignant still, right? And I think it is also very much about the ways that desire destabilizes us and makes us monstrous. But it almost, like, once you get in the habit of experiencing Lynch films in a way where you let go of that need to make things schematic, it starts to become strangely a little too neat. Not 100%, right? But to some extent.
The last question I had was just about what he writes in his book about digital cameras and the speed at which he could just sort of, like, create. And it sounds like Inland Empire is really the product of that sort of on-the-fly scripting and creation. Like, this is what I, you know, want this scene to be about, and allowing it to kind of make itself. And it just strikes me that, like, in addition to being, I really do believe Inland Empire is sometimes ugly on purpose, which really stands, it sticks out when you watch Eraserhead, which is beautiful. Like, it's a beautifully shot movie. And he did that on, you know, with no money and no recognition. I mean, Inland Empire would not succeed if it was the first film by anybody. Right? I mean, like, you would not have the patience for it.
Well, you don't get to make Inland Empire, which is, I'll be honest, I felt like it was a little indulgent. You know,
that's totally fine.
A little.
Please make a case.
I still thought it was great, but I think that, like, Lost Highway is, like, at 2 hours and 15 minutes for more, you know, for an impressionistic movie is already long. You know, I think we could have lost a few scenes from Inland Empire, but yeah, you don't get to make Inland Empire as your first film. No one lets you do that.
But even if you were able to make it, like, the
oh, you mean you wouldn't have the chops to do it?
No. Even if you managed, because like he did Eraserhead with his own money over several years, and weirdly, like bookending his filmography, you have this movie that he kind of cobbled together, from what I understand, with, you know, very little funding and just basically calling people in. That's why, you know, I think the ensemble nature of it is just sort of like, oh, I've got you for a few days, you know, like, let's, like, I think you kind of look like Terry Crews. Like, how about you sit down, put on this jacket and sit on the street, and we're gonna cover Laura Dern in blood, and you're just gonna like look all cross and upset. I mean, it does feel like a movie that you could just sort of create, but I don't think that you could create it and have anybody watch it or have it be successful. Successful is a relative term, but I just don't, it's, I guess, like, is Inland Empire a thing because of what we carry into it, knowing Lynch? Like it wouldn't be a thing without like the Lynch canon behind it. You wouldn't have any fucking patience for it, and you wouldn't be able to understand it.
I mean, I think there's certainly an argument to be made there that, you know, because it had the Lynch name attached to it. Like, I think it's a generally good film.
Is it, even if Lynch is it a good
isn't,
film?
Isn't the director?
Is it a good film, Patrick?
Yeah.
It is. It is a good film. It isn't just a bunch of. Laura Dern's amazing, but like, it's just Laura Dern in a bunch of situations looking, being amazing.
Well, I mean, she is awesome. She, like, her central monologue to the dude with glasses is pretty great. I mean, it's. Solid acting, tense scenes, even if there's narrative craziness, like it's pretty good. I mean, seems that way to me. Doesn't it seem that way to you, Hans?
Oh yeah, I love Inland Empire. I mean, I do 100% think, to your point, Chris, that like if it were presented to me without the things that we bring into that text do play a role in giving it the benefit of the doubt to give it the attention required absolutely. To crack it open. Right.
Right.
And I think, you know, like, I think the number of people who watch Inland Empire who are not committed fans of David Lynch willing to extend it whatever attention is needed to unlock it is probably going to be roughly zero, right? It's not like,
right.
I think lots of people have encountered Lost Highway expecting a relatively straightforward noir and been disappointed and confused, right? I mean, that was me at 17, but
right.
So, I mean, I don't think that it's some artistic objects are easier than others to imagine being encountered and enjoyed in a vacuum, right? I've been, for whatever reason, I'm using the term in a vacuum a lot today, but some artistic objects are easier to imagine. You know, like the whole point of a pop song is it's just immediately likable in a way where you don't need to know the background of the, you know, musician, or you don't need to bring anything to it, right? It exists independently. And it's very hard to imagine this film either existing or being enjoyed independent of the greater idea of David Lynch, but you don't need to imagine that because that's never going to happen. It necessarily and inevitably exists within the bigger idea of David Lynch. And, you know, within that, I think it's very enjoyable. I've continued to appreciate it more as I've rewatched it over 20 years.
I do think that what we're talking about here, it does point to a problem within, like, publishing art of any kind in general, right? So like the big book publishers, like, how there's like three, you know, Penguin, Random House, yada yada yada, they really only they don't really take chances, right? Like they don't really take a chance on a new author. Most of what they publish is either by authors who are already established or celebrities, right? Like that's kind of what the book publishing market is.
You mean that Prince Harry didn't like write, you know, Spare wasn't published because it's a fucking like brilliant memoir.
Right. It's because Prince Harry wrote it. And so I do think, like, I think it's bad that an unknown artist can't make Inland Empire and be successful. I think that's bad, but it is true, right? Like, if Inland Empire is a great movie, which I think it is really, really great, not perfect, but great, I think that it should be able to be published under anybody's name and it should be seen as great, right? Regardless of the filmmaker. Unfortunately, that's not the world we live in, though, right?
Well, and it does impose a certain amount of difficulty to hold that standard as a viewer and consumer, right? Because, like, the number of films that exist in the world is much greater than what I can take in, right? And
right.
Inland Empire, I think to, you know, I guess, well, Patrick, I guess you said that you admire it and like it and have only seen it one time. But I do think that it's probably, it's like, it's a three-watch movie, ultimately, right? Like,
sure. Like, I think I should watch it more to, like, totally get it.
Which represents 10 hours of time commitment. And so, to what, how do I know to extend the generosity of 10 hours of time to this very opaque text that on some level has a superficial resemblance to a complete pile of bullshit? One of those is the establishment of the idea of David Lynch, right? And I mean, it's not a perfect solution, sure. But it's, you know, you inevitably in a world where you can't try everything, you have to make a
certain. Well, I agree. I agree that that there's not much of a way around it that I can see. I'm just saying it's not great.
No, like, it's a sad fact of life.
Right, a sad fact of life, exactly.
It's more in the category of, like, people die young of cancer than it is the category of, you know, Harvey Weinstein is an asshole. It's like existentially unsolvable problems as opposed to systemic issues which can in fact be rectified with virtuous action.
Right. Like, we could do things about the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. It seems like it would be much harder to solve the problem of unknown artists, you know, going through life laboring for nothing. You know, that's an existential tragedy, but not much we can do about it that I know of.
Well, I think that that is all of my questions. Did either of you want to say anything about any one of these movies, the book, all of them together?
Patrick, did you have enough time to? You said at the beginning that you were hoping we would talk about Catching the Big Fish. Do you feel like we spent enough time on that?
We can talk. Well, we didn't really talk about it.
What did you want to say?
I mean, that for such a small book, it's such a great amount of horseshit going on in it. That's all, really.
Yeah.
You know, just so small and, like, almost nothing of value was said in it. It was, like, the Vedic science is the same as the unified field theory. Okay, buddy. Okay. You know, that's it.
Yeah, that's about, it's funny. Like, I have been intermittently interested in the idea of trying to use meditation to enhance my own creativity.
Right.
And so I was interested in this book, if for no other reason than I was actually, to some extent, pre-sold on what he was selling and ready to pay attention to what he had to say about meditation and creativity. Yeah. And he still managed to just completely disappoint the hell out of me.
Yeah. Like, I think that there probably really are empirical benefits to meditation. Like, I don't want to come off like, oh, meditation is for losers. I just, his spiritual mumbo jumbo was what irritated me. Like, yeah, there are absolutely benefits to meditating.
It's probably a bit like chiropractic medicine, right? Like, chiropractic medicine does, in fact, like, do positive things for people. But it's kind of framed in this just sort of context of mystical horse shit that doesn't really, I don't even know that the mystical horse shit has value at this point, right? It's just kind of like this vestigial attachment to a certain set of practices that do yield some benefit, although probably an easily overrated benefit.
Well, it reminded me of, was it, I can't remember her name, a musician. She was being interviewed about her music and, I'm totally drawing a blank, but she's kind of known for her lyrics and she really couldn't talk about like her music. Right. She, you know, and I think that that's not an uncommon thing because, they're different things, right? Like being able to express yourself in a compelling way is materially different from saying the, you know, the quiet thing out loud and just sort of baldly stating what it is, you know, that you're doing or how you or your process or anything like that. And it reminds me, you know, Hans and I were talking a few weeks ago about. I was trying to say that like, I was trying to describe parenthood. And I said that, you know, basically you spout a bunch of like Hallmarky bullshit and saccharine or like flat, seemingly meaningless stuff. Like you'll never be more tired or more fulfilled. And it doesn't convey any meaning because like the actual experience of parenthood is sort of like, it's not really bounded very well by language and you know, Hans, you had the great insight. You said like, well, it's just sort of like trying to convey the insights you have when you're high, where you're, you know, like you're stoned and you're like, oh my God, we are all one, and you feel it, like you feel the truth of that, but the actual statement is not very useful. And I think that like probably meditation being a very like, so chiropractic or whatever, like you talk about body health, like that, you know, and Patrick, you mentioned empirical evidence. Like, empirical evidence really does start to break down when you talk about the effect of something on a subjectivity, right? Like, basically, like, you know, the experience that someone thinks they're having, you know, is pretty indistinguishable on some level from the experience they're having. And so like, you know, I think that probably, you know, the book, I mean, obviously the book felt like it was meaningful to Lynch, but like it's from Lynch's own sort of structures of meaning. And so it doesn't really convey any information. I don't think that it's like, I don't know. I meditate, I try to, and I think that there is value, but I think that there's very diminishing value, almost like immediately, like no value to try and talk about like why it's useful. It really is such a personal experience. And then, you know, it's hard for to talk about that, a personal experience without it coming off this way. Especially I guess like if you're not, you know, that's probably why those grand narratives of you know, religion or sort of like spiritual practices exist, to kind of create a kind of like a strata on which like communication about these things is meaningful. But none of the three of us belong to the TM movement. where I think really, I mean, no shade to people who do, but, you know, I'm not going to pay someone $1,000 to teach me how to fucking meditate. So
I think that if David Lynch knew that our podcast about him and his work and his life, that the last
sentence shitting on TM
before the final sum up would be that the last sentence before the final summing up would be, I'm not going to fucking pay somebody $1,000 to teach me to meditate. He would be unhappy. He would feel as though he had failed.
He'd be, I'm sorry, Lynch. Hey, no, I love your work. Your work is,
he died, guys. Yeah.
He died, but just sending good vibes, you know, just to say something about Lynch, the people who expressed really like deep feelings about like his passing were so diverse and from so many different walks of life, at least around me, that it really seems like he reached a lot of people, and a lot of people very cared about him a lot. You know, but you know, they didn't read his fucking book, which, you know, maybe that's a good thing. All right. What are we doing next?
I guess I had waffled a little bit on whether I was going to go ahead with this, but because we are doing movies for this episode, I thought it would be interesting to go ahead for the next episode with a novel on the subject of film that connects to some other novels on the subject of film. So a little while ago, I had said that I reread The Book of Illusion by Paul Auster because it struck me as being in my own mind, sort of like an unofficial triarchy of 70s, 80s, 90s. Well, I guess more like, I don't know about the timing, but it struck me in my mind as being kind of an unofficial triarchy of novels about film, along with Zeroville by Steve Erickson and Flicker by Theodore Rorschach, both of which we had read for the podcast. So I am choosing Paul Auster's Book of Illusion. I'm probably going to try to reread Zeroville. That might be, if you guys are able to kind of reread Zeroville in preparation, you certainly don't have to, but I'll probably be trying to talk about Book of Illusion, partly in relationship to Zeroville and Zeroville and Flicker. So if you're able to reacquaint yourselves with those two texts enough to be able to at least kind of tie bits of them together or tie the ideas of them together, that would be good. Maybe just go back and, you know, re-listen to our recent Flickr episode. I might do that. I never listen to episodes of the podcast because I hate my own voice, but I might try that with Flickr. And yeah, so Book of Illusion, cool. And hopefully some callbacks to Flickr and Zeroville.
Thank you both. Thank you, listeners. Watch David Lynch. These are, you know, singular. There's not anything else like them. And I think they're beautiful and amazing. Just don't read them. So with that note, we'll see you next time.
All right. Peace out.
Bye, everyone.